You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Reading Kiesar Khan's moving new memoir, An American Family, I'm reminded of how much those of us who were born in the United States take for granted about our country. As a new immigrant from Pakistan in the 1970s, among the wonders that Kiesar Khan marveled at were buses that came on time, utility companies that came within days to install a phone, a DMV that didn't operate by bribes. By the time he was 15, as he told the high school students today, he had already lived twice under martial law. Most of us also take for granted our founding documents, the ones we've read in civics classes in high school, or didn't. One of my favorite scenes in Mr. Khan's book is after his first readings of the Declaration of Independence. While he was studying law at Punjab University Law College, he was 22 at the time, he exclaimed excitedly to a fellow student, "Have you heard about what happened in the United States? How it became a country?" I just love that. And what he sees in this thrilling document, what he grasped so quickly, is the story, he said, of colonized people everywhere. Kiesar Khan is the eldest of 10 children, and he was raised in rural Pakistan. He and his wife became American citizens and raised their three sons in Silver Spring, Maryland. He's a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States and the District of Columbia, the New York State Bar, American Law Association, and his law practice includes, among many other fields, civil rights and veterans' rights advocacy. He's going to be in conversation tonight with Jeffrey Fleischman, a culture and film writer for the Los Angeles Times, who is himself a longtime foreign and war correspondent with postings in Rome, Berlin, and Cairo, and as well the author of two very fine novels. Kiesar Khan, I'm sure as you all know, came into our national consciousness at the 2016 Democratic Convention. He came to speak as a Gold Star father, his wife Ghazala beside him, about the sacrifice his son had made for America. His son Humayun was killed at age 27 in Iraq, protecting his men from suicide bombers, and was posthumously awarded the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart. And Mr. Khan electrified the audience when he plucked from his jacket pocket a copy of the U.S. Constitution, waved it aloft, and offered to lend it to the then Republican candidate to read, probably for the first time ever. So his new book, and I'll turn it over to them soon, An American Family, is both the story of the Khan family and as well a universal story of migration, struggle, hope, and achievement. And it's also a love story told by a man who courted his wife with a gift of 21 sparrows in a cage meant to be set free. It's the story of a man who has a favorite amendment to the Constitution. And I can't think of a more inspiring way to end this season's Aloud series. Please welcome Kiesar Khan and Jeffrey Fleischman. Thank you.
Well, we were talking earlier, and this is your 176th city this year, correct?
Yes.
So
and many more to go.
Yeah. You are a tireless man. One of the many things I liked about your book was the simpleness of and poetry in your chapter headings. 21 sparrows, shoeless, and a shaft of sunlight. It's quite evocative. And the other thing it made me think, and Louise mentioned it in the introduction, is that many of us were born in this country. Those who came like you did embraced it, which is a different kind and a deeper kind of love. And immigrants and people I've met over the years, I've asked them, well, why did you come to America? And they would say, well, I saw it. My visions of it were in movies, on Hollywood. I read about it, the aspirational dreams of family members who came, and I followed them. But you've got, I never knew anyone to say that the 14th Amendment was the reason that I came. So if you could explain that, it would be great. Yeah.
14th Amendment and Declaration of Independence. And the date the very first thing about America I saw was 4th of July, 1776, and the words Declaration of Independence. Wait a minute. Who declares independence? People are given independence. You struggle, you ask, you beg, you appeal, you protest. But what are these people that are declaring their independence in 1776? Because I know a little bit about the colonization and colonized part of the world. The rest of the humanity suffered for another 200 years. Whereas America and its forefathers had the courage and the guts, we are going to free ourselves, we are going to declare the independence. So I read that very first document in one standing, understanding half of it because it's little difficult English. Next morning I talked to my friend who was doing his master's program in English literature and asked him, explain to me some of these sentences and sentiments that I don't understand, and he did. And I remain in awe, and I implore all entire America to read Declaration of Independence again under these difficult circumstances that our nation is going through. Then I read the articles. Articles made perfect sense. That is how civilized people live. Rule of law, separation of power, relationships of states and federal government, various institutions of the government, why it is important for us to have these institutions. And then I read the best part that remains at in the deepest core of my heart, the Bill of Rights. I have stopped calling it Bill of Rights. I call them that is the Bill of Human Dignities. Rest of the world aspires to have all those dignities. So I read the First Amendment, then the Second, Third, Fourth, and all. And best of all has become the 14th Amendment, Section 1. Equal protection of law, equal dignity for all citizens, regardless of what color we have, what name we have, what origin we have. We are all treated equal. And that is the hallmark of this blessed nation.
That is the hallmark, and the ideals are there everlasting. But do you feel, given what's transpired over the last year, that a sense of betrayal of those in some ways?
Well, this is what my humble observation had been. I'm an observer. I'm not an intellectual, not a politician, not a leader, but an observer. My observation had been that we had not been vigilant about our values, about our democracy. Captain Humayun Khan, when he was gaining, he was a cadet at ROTC. He was gaining admission to a dormitory. The name of the dormitory at University of Virginia is Hereford College. They required for a candidate to write an article. If it is worthy, then you're given admission to that, to live in that dormitory. He wrote an article that applies so correctly today, and the title of that article was Democracy Requires Vigilance and Sacrifice. We as a nation, prior to the election of 2016, have not been vigilant. We were least participating nation in our democratic process.
Why did we become complacent, in your estimation?
It is nature of national affairs. Sometimes the exploitation by narrow-minded politicians. Sometimes prosperity. Sometimes lack of challenge makes us complacent. And we saw what took place. Slowly and gradually, we are finding out that those who do not wish us well, and I mean specifically those countries that do not wish us well, in my simple mind, the world is divided in two sections. On one hand, you have oligarchs, dictators, martial law administrators, authoritarian rulers, manipulating general public and people's rights. They are very rich. They have bank accounts throughout the world, yet the population suffers. I have lived twice under those circumstances under martial law. And then the second half is people like us, people of democratic values, where we decide who will govern us, who will lead us, what laws we want to adopt. Sometimes we make mistakes, but in democratic process, there is a process. Next election, you change all that. Therefore, yes, yes. Therefore, if we were complacent, we are not anymore. This nation has learned that if we remain complacent, if we do not participate fully in taking charge of our democracy, such anomaly will continue to happen. This is an anomaly. This is a momentary anomaly in the blessed history of this nation. I come from Charlottesville, Virginia. Virginia. We decided we will change the course of our history last November 7th. I was there. I was there. I saw the line, longest line I've ever seen to cast votes. Women were in majority with their overcoats, umbrella in their hand, just in case it rain, I'm not going to move from this line. Sneakers so that their feet won't get tired if they have to stand a few hours longer. And look, the result. We sent the message throughout the nation that this is how democratic people change the course of history. And we did.
This, in the course of bending history or changing the course of events, as you're experiencing personally, there's a cost that comes with it. You have to travel with more security. Your freedom of speech is existent, but there are enemies out there that have been threatening to you. How do you deal and reconcile with these things and keep them in balance?
Well, those are the costs. I had the choice. I have the choice to go and live where I came from in 1980. Go live under those circumstances. I do not wish to live with those indignities that I left behind. I tell you, the event, such a profound impact. I wish all America would read the oath of citizenship which I took in 1986 when I became citizen of this blessed country. I was asked to come to the federal courthouse for the swearing-in ceremony, citizenship ceremony. I went to the courthouse. I paused outside for a minute. I have studied law. I have lived under two martial laws in my earlier life, once when I was in middle school, second when I was in law school. I counted the indignities that I had gone through up until that moment. I entered the courtroom. There were several other new citizens. We took the oath of citizenship and then we were given a certificate. It's a green ink certificate. It says Certificate of Naturalization and Citizenship. To my blurry eyes at that moment when I looked at that certificate, even today, I lose my composure when I think of those moments, how dignified I felt that all the rights that I never had before this blessed ceremony, now I do. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom of press. I have them now. Those are guaranteed to me. So it is all those blessings that I have received, this risk and inconvenience and traveling and not feeling well, yet continuing to travel one city to another city, one community to another community, that's a small price. It's a gesture of gratitude.
When you stepped on the stage at the Democratic National Convention, it was to honor your son who was bravely killed in Iraq. And so a personal moment became a politically iconic moment. It was one of the defining moments of the campaign. Two things. How did you worry in the course of those things, given the way politics are, that you could be manipulated? And two, how has it changed your life since?
Yeah, we were told when the invitation came to appear at the Democratic National Convention, we were told that there are other families also coming because their Gold Star families and tribute is being paid to their loved one and they are speaking and you're welcome to come as well. They had selected Captain Humayun Khan to be among those. And so I asked my children, should we go? And we were told, do not go. You're not that kind of person. You do not. You have never been involved in politics ever before, so just decline that. I thought they were being overprotective of us, so I asked some other friends that are a little more savvy in politics, and they told us exactly same thing, do not go. Do not go. Your peace will be maligned, your reputation, your integrity, your life will not be the same because of its ritual, its practice, criticism, right or wrong, maligning of character, right or wrong, but that is how life is in politics. So we sat for 2 days thinking, should we go or shouldn't we go? What really sent us there was those small children that were reaching out to us, knowing that I practice law. Wherever I would go among friends and our children, their friends with small children, middle school, elementary school children will come to me and will ask, are we going to be thrown out of this country? We are born here. We don't know where we would go. Our parents are born here. We look different. So I would hearten them. I would bring them close to my heart. And I would read them the 14th Amendment, Section 1, equal protection and all.
Like a bedtime story. Yeah.
And some children would be heartened. Most of them would not. And their parents would later on call and they would say that they don't want to go to school because in school they were being bullied that, oh, when you go back home, your parents would have been taken. You will never see them again. So they don't want to go to school. So this was going on one hand in our life when this invitation came. So we went to speak for that. We had no concern of being manipulated or being used or what. We thought this was a platform. And we sat for 2 days in the room where Captain Humayun Khan's portrait is placed. And Ghazala and I spoke, should we go or shouldn't we go? And we almost decided at the advice of our well-wishers that we would not go. Then our second day in the afternoon, I go to check the mail. And in the mailbox, there is a white envelope without a stamp. So somebody must have come and placed that card. And I hurriedly opened it. And the name of the middle school, four names, and then one line that sent us there. And the line said, Mr. and Mrs. Khan, can you make sure that Maria is not thrown out of this country? She's our friend. We love her. I read it twice standing at the mailbox and I brought that letter to Ghazala. I said, look, we had been praying for the message. Here is the message. And she looked at me and she said, please call them and tell them we will come and we will speak. So it is that now we can, those who wish to criticize could call it manipulation, could call it whatever they want to call, that's fine, but that was what was taking place, what took us there. And there is an interesting story of writing this speech. When I called them and told them we will come, they told me, you have 2 minutes, say whatever you wish to say. I said, that's good enough. So I started to write the speech that very night, sitting upstairs in the bedroom, and 5 pages, 7 pages, 10 pages, altogether 12 pages, and Ghazala
wakes up. You had a lot to say.
Yeah, exactly. All of my grievances were listed on those 12 pages. So I told Ghazala, wakes up very early. I came down and I told her, I said, would you hold this clock and see if I can finish these 12 pages? These 12 pages in 2 minutes, and she said, let's go. So she sat down, and I start to read. Of course, that was first draft, and it 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 18 minutes. She has never called me Mr. Khan before, but that day she said, Mr. Khan, they will turn off the mic, they will turn off the lights, and so let's narrow it down. And she took those 12 pages and she began to do the... She always had been a wonderful editor of my life, and she cleaned it up and all that. The world doesn't know. The very first line that this dignified, graceful lady took off from my speech was this. These are my words. I have not plagiarized from Mrs. Obama's speech. She said, no, you will not say that.
Maybe hitting below the belt. Huh?
That was my first line. So people who criticize say, well, it was written for him, someone and all that, and you and I have been speaking, and you can judge that I can express my thoughts and I can explain to them, I can express without any hesitation, and I'm an articulate person, so there was no need for anyone else to write my speech, what I wanted to say.
Well, that comes in your book. It's a wonderful mixture of eloquence and pragmatism. Because when you mention in the book that you once wore a cowboy hat and listened to country music, I found that doesn't go with the man sitting in front of me.
I have picture to prove.
No, I know. One of the things that there's so much to talk about, but one of the things I'd that's bothered me over the course of some time is America's stature in the world. Having lived overseas for many years, it's drastically changed, it's bipartisan in nature. I think President Obama decided to retract a bit from the world, and President Obama has filled that vacuum with something that a lot of people find noxious around the world. President Trump, sorry.
Thank you for the correction.
Yeah, but anyway, I wanted to know from someone who was an immigrant who aspired to come here, what is it saying to the rest of the world, and how do we need to fix that as a society? You can say all you want, oh, we have wonderful constitutional protections and ideals, but when they're not practiced in a day-to-day dignity, as you said, to people, what does that say to the world about what America has become over time?
Well, this is not first time that that our fundamental values are facing challenge. I met a very learned scholar of history and the Constitution, and he told me something so profound that I wish to share, is that the existence of this blessed union was in severe danger of dissolving at the time of inception. The first few years were very tumultuous time. It was thought that this union will not last. We have lasted all these years. We just celebrated 230 years of our Constitution, 240 years of our Declaration of Independence, and we will continue to celebrate. So that's one. Second event, he said, was where the existence of the most dangerous time in our history was civil war. It was thought by the leaders and by the general population that this union will not last. We survived that. And these are his words, that this moment in the history of the United States is the third moment where we are at such a risky moment that our existence is in question. Of course, he was highlighting the dangers that exist and our position in the world, because we continue to get up from the table of the world where the world sits and walk out from there. Of course, somebody has to fill the gap. China, Russia, these are the countries that have long waited to find their seat on the table. We were their competitors. We were the leaders on those tables, but we have begun to withdraw from that table. But I assure you this, I keep repeating myself ad nauseum, example of Virginia, that this nation, and I have traveled, as I mentioned, from Portland, Oregon, to Toledo, to Pittsburgh, to Minnesota, to Indianapolis, Houston, Boston, New York, and in between, and California, San Francisco. Tomorrow is Seattle. Day after tomorrow is Phoenix. The concern that we all feel, the concern that you have expressed, the concern that this scholar expressed, believe me, that those concerns are real in the hearts and minds of all of us concerned Americans. And we are at a juncture where we have decided, most communities have decided, what course of action to take to repel all this downslide that is taking place in the stature of United States throughout the world. And we have decided that we will take our country back. We will claim our country back through the democratic process. We are the people of democracy. We are the people that conduct our affairs with civility. We do not malign each other. We disagree with one another, but we conduct our affairs with civility. So through that discourse, through that that action, through that line of action, by participation, it may be simple-minded, but that is the solution that we will regain the control of our nation. And the founding values of our nation are intact, will remain intact, because our institution, of our democracy are intact. They may have been attacked, but they have not been weakened. We will continue to prevail. These values will continue to prevail. We will celebrate, God willing, another 230 years of the goodness of America. America as beacon of hope. I have not given up hope. The reason is that whenever I travel, when so many people are so concerned, some are afraid, most of them are concerned, they come up with the solution. And Virginia did come up with the solution.
Your son, Humayun, paid the ultimate sacrifice for what you were just saying. And Gold Star families, as you know, have been in the news a lot with the recent death of Sergeant Law David Johnson, and you were kind of dragged into the fray again on that with over General Kelly / Citizen Kelly, as you pointed out on one show. But what is the... There's no depth that any leader or anybody can express that can console a shattered parent that way. But what is the proper way, in your estimation, for a president to handle that kind of thing?
Yeah. It's not really very complicated, but the basic character of a leader is empathy, that you empathize, you feel the pain that a citizen, those who have served this nation with the last breath of their life, they must be dignified. Their families must be dignified and respected. But that can only happen where there is empathy, when there is compassion. Donald Trump lacks that. That had been my statement then and my statement now, that element of empathy is missing. And time after time, incident after incident, had proven that realization, that compassion, that leadership trait, fundamental trait of empathy is missing in this president. So what that does, it transfers the responsibility of conducting these matters with utmost dignity upon his enablers, upon those who enable him to function day to day, meaning those who are on our payroll, who are on public's payroll, and rightly we have every right to criticize their incompetence if they show incompetence. So that indignity that was displayed in the course of the death of my son, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, and the lack of courtesy that was expressed in this lack of protocol, President doesn't pick up the number and dials the number and calls, say, I'm calling because of this and all this, this. It doesn't happen that way at all. There is a protocol. White House calls the family. Do you have privacy? Are you willing to take the call from the president? Do you have some place where you are sitting down? Do you wish to call someone else to be with you? People don't just pick up the phone. And in this case, this was just total disregard, total lack of courtesy, lack of dignity, extension of it towards the family. They are traveling in the car towards the funeral home and this call is made. For God's sake, ask them, where are you? Are you driving? Are you in the car? Is this the right time? We would like to have privacy and peace and quiet so the president can express condolence of the nation. When the president calls, it's not Donald Trump calling. It's the condolence of the nation being expressed to that family. Where are these people on our payroll, these incompetents sitting in the White House? And it is that was missing, and it was that I was criticizing, that we know he's unable. He's totally void of empathy. But these people on our payroll, so incompetent that they're not following a protocol.
Yep. I'd like you to read, if you would, the passage we discussed.
Sure.
It starts here.
Our son's headstone is a slab of white marble with soft streaks, the color of wood smoke, a rectangle except for the top, which is rounded off in a shallow arc, a star nestled inside a crescent moon is etched at the top. Above his name, his rank and branch of service, the date of his birth and the date of his death, the medals the army awarded him, and the conflict, Operation Iraqi Freedom, in which he died. 27 years reduced to 11 carved lines. It was placed in Section 60 of Arlington National Cemetery at the end of a row of other marble headstones that condense the lives of other sons and daughters into too few chiseled words. Himayun was buried there 1 week after he was killed on June 15th, a hot, clear day on the eve of summer. The deputy chief of mission from the Pakistani embassy was there. Himayun was the highest ranking Pakistani American to die in Iraq. An army chaplain read a letter from Himayun's commanding officer, who was still overseas. He died selflessly and courageously, tackling the enemy head on, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Mitchell had written. We will not forget him and the noble ideas he stood for. I believe that was true. I hope that was true. A bugler played taps. Six officers in dress uniform lifted the flag covering, my son's casket and folded it into a tight triangle. One of them carried it gently, as if it were a fragile thing that might shatter, to Ghazala, clicked his heels, bent forward, and held it out to her. She accepted it, tears streaming down her cheeks. There would be other memorials, two in Charlottesville over the summer, another at Fort Knox in the fall, where we would sit in a grandstand and look over young lieutenants in formation on the parade ground. They all look like Himayun, Ghazala would whisper to me. and she would be right. Their uniforms, their posture, they each were someone's child.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. There are two reasons why that so moved me when I read it. One was the obvious care and eloquence in the way the words are to describe, obviously, a fallen son. But the next part of it that rang through and rang through the entire book is the love affair. This is a memoir, a journey of a man who left Pakistan, went to Harvard, slept in Boston Common, raised a family, succeeded on all levels. But it's also quite a love story, hence the 21 sparrows. tell us about Ghazala and how you fell in love.
Well, she had been since day one the center of gravity for the family. Captain Humayun Khan was her replica. Care for others, love for everyone, decency, elegance, very dignified. When I met her first, the very first gesture that I even remember today, there was a ceremony, an ambassador had come to her department. They had invited me as well because I spoke Persian. She brought the tea in tray, and instead of serving it to the ambassador first, she took it to her mentor, professor, first. Served him the first cup, then she brought. And that was observed by everyone, that this lady has the caliber and dignity of remembering that that professor that is teaching her has the highest regard in this gathering. And so that was the gesture I noticed. And thereafter, it was a hide-and-seek kind of thing. I didn't want to tell her that I have liked her. I had no guts or courage to stand in front of her. So I would always make an excuse, walk faster or walk slow so I can pass her and sheepishly say hi to her and wait for her reply and all this. So,
and you had to win over her mother. It wasn't easy.
Yes.
The father, you kind of worked around.
Yeah, no, father was very, very humble and decent person, and so was her mother. But her mother, out of care for her, because they knew that I am of modest means, even after becoming law graduate, there was no guarantee of decent living in Pakistan under those circumstances. So she was right. She was concerned about the well-being of her daughter because there were other suitors that had more in the family that would have been a more suitable match. But here we are.
How did she handle President Trump's next?
With amazing grace, she wrote a wonderful op-ed in Washington Post where she tells him that, what do you know? What a grieving mother feels. My son's photo is he's being paid tribute to, and his picture is... I am full aware his photo is right there. And what do you know how a grieving mother feels having lost such a wonderful, beautiful son? She did not take it personally. She was annoyed at the display of ignorance and meanness. I was more annoyed than she was. She was the calming person in our life. She remains that way, this was out of ignorance, out of not being aware. The reason was that I asked her, she knew that, I asked her throughout this event of the convention that, please speak, say something. Say simply, thank you for inviting us and paying tribute to Captain Humayun Khan, and we are honored, and Khizr will speak. She said, you know that I will fall apart the moment I open my mouth, with full realizing that my son's picture is on the screen. And it has happened in the past. Whenever somebody had spoken so lovingly about Humayun and she's there, she cannot keep herself composed. So she said that this will indignify the moment, so don't insist. That is when I said to her that, okay, I will make sure that you hold the podium tightly. And I was paying attention to her holding, standing next to me, because I knew that if things got too rough, she may collapse. And that was my concern. But what does outside world or others know? Only those who have children, mothers especially, know what it feels and how it feels.
I'd like to ask one more question and then we'll open up to questions. Around the world, when you look now from Europe to here, you see the rise of right-wing populism, you see the alt-right, you see in other parts of the world, you see Islamic fundamentalism, Islamic radicalism. They both fuel and feed one another and are exploited by politicians, and a culture of fear has set in. But how, and then when we had President Trump just recognized Jerusalem, which is going to, depending on what side you're on politically, is certainly going to set off another thing. How do we, you've been around, you travel a lot, you talk to a lot of people, how do we calm these demons?
Yeah, coming back to our basic democratic values, that in democracy, such tumultuous time ought to be handled with care, handled with dignity, handled with courtesy and respect. We don't become violent or lose our civility. I was in Charlottesville on 12th of August when that ugly march took place, the march full of hate, the slogans that entire America heard. We saw the Nazi flag on the streets of Charlottesville on 12th of August. I was there. Then I was there on 13th of August, Saturday, when my daughter, Heather Hare, was murdered by the car driver. I call her my daughter out of affection. But very few people know what took place on Wednesday night. And that is how we are going to come out of this hate, divisiveness, and fear. On Wednesday, Charlottesville decided that we are going to show our children and our families what true American values are. Through word of mouth, thousands of families walked on the same path where this ugly march has taken place 2 days ago. With children in tow, candles in their hands, we went all the way to, no announcement was made, no media was invited. We went to the sacred ground of University of Virginia. We stood there. Our children were heartened. They saw so many families supporting one another, walking together, and we came back home. It is that each community being aware of how to repel this division and this hate that somehow, not only here, as you mentioned, in other parts of the world, the extremism, it will be defeated. It has no place. Look, the world is becoming aware of it. This script of hate and division had given us two world wars. First world war, same hatred. Nationalism, economic well-being, fear of immigrants. The script of the First World War, atrocities throughout the world. Second World War, exactly same three elements. Fear of nationalism, fear of immigrants, economic well-being. The foundation of this hate that we see on the streets of United States these days, here and there, here, there, is exactly same. Fear of immigrants, nationalism, economic well-being. But it is bogus. Majority of America realizes that that's not where prosperity lies, because the world saw that this script has given us two world wars. Then the second half of the last century came United Nations. Of course, there's so much better we can do, but came United Nations, people joining hands, came European Union. Europe decided in being together is prosperity. And then came NATO, that in having common defense, we will defeat the hate and division. And the entire world saw the most prosperity in the second half of last century than ever before. So it is that the history is in front of us, that division and hate can cause those atrocities. Unity, coming together, respect towards each other will bring more prosperity and peace to the world. I received a 26-page letter. Among thousands and thousands of letters that we have received, the cards, one letter stands out and it says this. This is written by a Second World War Army nurse. By the way, I want to pay tribute to our veterans and their families in the audience. Because of your sacrifice, because of your leadership, we are safe. I wish to also pay tribute to the families and the members of our law enforcement and your families. Because of your sacrifice and your service, we are safe. So thank you very much. So this retired army nurse writes 26 pages of this letter. In 25, she explains that what took place in Second World War and how she served, what she saw. And then on 26th page, she writes this. She says, Mr. and Mrs. Khan, please continue to speak. Had more people spoken prior to Second World War, we could have avoided Second World War. And the atrocities that were committed against mankind could have been avoided. Especially the atrocities against our Jewish brothers and sisters could have been avoided. So continue to speak. What I mean to say by this is that we have seen this division and hatred and fear-mongering, what it has done in the last century to mankind. We will not. The humanity is ready to throw this division and hate out of here. Okay. We will prevail. The peace will prevail, the togetherness will prevail, the 14th Amendment and equal protection will prevail.
Okay. And we have some questions. Somebody down here?
First question. I just want to say thank you so much for writing this wonderful book. I think it really gave face and a human aspect toward Islam. I learned a lot about your faith, and I feel like I got to know Captain Humayun. And I also wanted to say thank you so much for talking to the children, elementary school, middle school, high school students, because I think that's where everything need to start. And I'm a Rotarian, and I'm planning a Rotary Community Peace Conference in April next year. And it's a finale of a peace educational program that we started at Glendale Unified School District, and I hope that you may be able to come and speak to us.
Is that a question or a...
Wonderful. I wish to add something. Just a quick thought that had occurred to me. Talking about the difficulty that we are going through at this moment, and what gives us hope. It reminded me, 1882. This nation passed. Politicians passed Chinese Exclusion Act, where hardworking Chinese were told that you are not welcome here anymore, leave. Then in 1942, Japanese internment executive order was passed, these patriot, peace-loving part of the community of United States were interned. Then the struggle of our civil rights leaders. On November 7, I sometime get up and I don't feel like voting, don't feel like standing in line, not realizing how much sacrifice our civil rights leaders have gone through to for me to have the right to vote. So where we are standing today, regardless of this momentary ugliness, we have come long way. We have our communities, several parts of this blessed nation have suffered difficulties, but we have remained united, we have remained faithful, and we will continue to move forward because that is the spirit. As I said, we celebrated 230 years of our Constitution and its rule of law and its equal protection and equal dignity, and we will continue to remain that. Momentary anomaly has taken place. We will remain beacon of hope for the rest of the world because of our founding values, because of these universal truths. When I talk about these Declaration of Independence or Bill of Rights or Articles, these documents contain some universal truths that every human being, every person born on this planet Earth, member of the mankind, wishes to have, aspires to have. We are guaranteed. These rights for us have been made inalienable, but these are not self-executory. You and I make them executory. Inalienable, yes, written in our document and all that, but to make sure that we stand with for those rights, whenever those rights are violated, be it president or be it anyone else, we must question, challenge, and speak.
Another question?
Thank you for your wonderful insights tonight. I was curious if you have any insights on the immigrant experience and how certain people have essentially played on the fact that it's a proxy for those who are Native of America, who see the immigrant as those who are giving them financial pain and thus transfer their aggression towards the immigrant as opposed to sort of understanding what the world is like and what's happening to them.
Sure. Quickly, let me state some facts. There are 7 million young Americans unemployed today. That becomes the focus of this. See how many Americans are sitting and have no employment and all that. But then they only tell half the truth. There are 6.2 million vacancies that require technology training that we have not prepared these 7 million Americans to take those jobs. These technology leaders are running out to different countries and bringing these people in so that they can run their companies, so that they can run their businesses. It is our failure as a nation to prepare our future generation. This afternoon I was talking to our future leaders, and I mentioned to them that don't get exploited because of that. Ask the next question. What have you done to prepare these 7 million unemployed Americans instead of exploiting their fear and the hatred of immigrants? Immigrants come to make life better for themselves and for their families and for their community and for their country. Canada has that policy, immigration policy. United States does not. We have laws, but we do not have policy. You will ask, what is the difference between laws and policies? Here is the difference. In policy, in laws, you have who qualifies, when, under what category, how much fee, which form, and all of that, and how long it should take, and who should come, who should not come. Those are laws. Policy is this. How many people are retiring in next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, from what sector, be it farming, be it manufacturing, be it industry, be it coal mining? How many people are retiring during these 5, 10, 20 years? Who is going to replace them? what vacancies, what industries would require what talent that we should prepare so that we can employ them in those sectors, what income, how these vacancies will be filled so that we have enough supply of our own manpower instead of importing. How much we will import, it is determined. If you read the Canada's immigration policy, I have read it. I am amazed that America does not have a policy. It is that causes, it is that makes this issue so disingenuous to point finger towards, as my brother said, towards the immigrants, that they are taking our jobs, they are taking our jobs. It is the lack of leadership. It is the lack of policy. It is the lack of a sober-minded thinking nationally. These are wonderful leaders. I sit with them, I talk to them and all. They all are in agreement that we should have a immigration policy. And we will, and we will.
What can I do to stop Trump from moving our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem? That could start World War III. I've lived long enough, and I know the Palestinian people, and I know the Jewish people, because I'm part Jewish. So I don't know what I can do.
No, don't underestimate the power of your voice. Continue to speak. One group, 5 people, 10 people, 20 people, 500 people, 5,000 people, continue to speak that this is not a wiser way to solving the problem. Express your concern to you. I was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The hall was full of wonderful audience. Half of them were veteran, and most of them identified themselves, we voted for Donald Trump. But we have a question to ask you, Mr. Khan. One of the veterans stood up, and she lifted her arm sleeve, and she showed me the dialysis marks on her wrist, on her elbow. And she said, I am on dialysis. I am worried to death about my health care, Mr. Khan. We were told that we will have better health care, we will have better wages, we will have better employment. None of that has taken place. What should I do, as you have asked, what should I do? My advice to her was that tomorrow morning when you wake up, take few of your other friends, call your senator, call your congressman, and tell him you want to hear from him in the halls of Congress about your concern. If you are not going to speak on these issues, I will neither vote nor contribute, and all of my friends, all of my circle of friends will never vote for you and all that. And it worked. And it worked. I received the email from the same person. She said to me, she said, Mr. Khan, he assured me that I will speak and I will not vote for the repeal of ACA, and it was defeated. And these are Republicans. So what I mean to say is that voice your concern. Whatever circle you have, 5, 10, write, ask newspaper to raise this issue, and we will move forward with that. That's all a citizen can do, and it has amazing power. It has amazing impact.
Any more questions?
Hi, thank you so much for coming. If you could get 5 minutes with Robert Mueller, what would you ask him to do? What advice would you give him?
No, I am a licensed attorney. I need to maintain my practice and license. I would remain quiet. I would simply just get out of his way. Let him continue. He's on right track. He's on right track.
Okay.
I was struck by many of your earlier comments referring to the United States as a blessed nation. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how your faith and the values of your faith have been affirmed by your life in the United States.
Well, literally, I have explained everything in the book. By the way, there is another book which is titled This is our constitution, which is written for our middle school children. So the proceeds of both of these books are dedicated to a scholarship that we have established under the name of Captain Humayun Khan Memorial Scholarship at University of Virginia. In perpetuity, on need base, that scholarship will be awarded. The first scholarship was awarded last week to the freshmen. We received a card. We were grateful. And the card said from this recipient that, thank you for making the university education possible for me. So from the proceeds of this book, there are example after example in our life where every step of the way, my faith, my belief in the goodness of this nation is affirmed. I can sit here and tell you the story of Paulette when we first landed. The generosity, she came, I had just taken kids inside, family had just come in, and I heard the knock at our apartment. I had rented a $200 a month apartment in Houston, and Paulette knocks at the door, and I open it. I knew she was our neighbor. She had two grocery bags in her hand, and she said, I saw that you have small children, they may be hungry. I brought some things for them. Nothing, some cookies, bread, milk, water, some juice, and just ordinary things. She did not ask us, where are you from? What language? What faith you practice? It was pure goodness of her heart that she came to welcome us. And that had been our experience throughout our lives, time after time after time, be it Boston, be it Maryland, Washington, Virginia, Charlottesville. If you came to our home today and you parked your car for 1 minute in front of our home, three of our neighbors would come out with their cameras in their hand and they will begin to take your picture.
I'll take an Uber.
They have become our protectors. They know that we face some difficulties at this time, and they have become our neighbors. So it is that this just doesn't happen. It happens because basically, fundamentally, the imprint of our values on the hearts and minds and mentality of this nation is goodness. These are good people, pure-hearted, kind, thoughtful people, welcoming of others. We have been welcomed throughout this country wherever we have gone through. Ghazala has never changed her original clothing that she wears, Pakistani clothing, Muslim clothing. She had never been questioned. You ask her anytime, have you been questioned? Have you been challenged? Have you been malignly looked at? She would tell you that. Never.
But we can't. At the same time, we can't be naive to what exists out there either. There are some serious problems with this country, and
I 100% agree.
And the blessings, but there are also stuff.
I 100% agree. I have stood in front of those Muslim women that wear the hijab that have faced difficulty, ugliness that had been thrown towards them. Yes, those challenges do exist. But then there is goodness as well. We can limit only our expression of that ugliness, or with that we express. I was in Portland, Oregon, after the end of the conversation. Two Muslim women with hijab came to me with their children, two of them. And they said to me that we want you to know this. We were standing at the bus stop and waiting for the school bus to come so we can send our children to school. A gentleman, a Caucasian gentleman from across the street came towards us halfway, middle of the road. He pointed the finger towards us and we begin to shake and tremble that something ugly is about to happen. And this is what he said, "Sisters, I am with you. Never feel alone." And he just kept walking. It is that we can focus on that, or we can focus that the ugliness that prevails, the communities that are being attacked by these cowards. We have been attacked. through mail, through voicemails and all that. But look, when we receive the mail, I am pointing something so profound. Please think about it. When we receive the mail, I can tell by looking at the letters without opening them which are good, which are bad. You know how?
I can guess, but I'll let you.
Those letters that have bad in them, they do not write their return address. They do not write their name if I open them. That speaks volume to this ugliness, the cowardice of this ugliness. It is cowardice. They fully realize that this will not do, this will not prevail. Goodness will prevail. The good of this country will prevail. This ugliness, this selfishness, serious challenges, yes. Communities are suffering because mosques have been burned. In Victoria, Texas, Muslim mosque was burned. So, look what happened. The custodians of the synagogue took the keys and gave it to the Muslim and say, here, up until you build the mosque, come and worship with us. How could we forget that gesture? Yes, the mosque was burned. So tragic, so un-American, so expression of hate. But then look how community resolved it, that the synagogue gave the keys to the Muslims and say, please come and pray every Friday here up until your mosque is rebuilt. It is that is taking place. We need to somehow keep both sides in our vision. And it is by that comparison we will prevail. Good always prevails, and it has prevailed before, and it will prevail again.
Mr. Khan, thank you for being here tonight. I've been waiting for weeks for tonight.
Yes.
In preparation for 2018 and 2020, and we live in a bubble on the West Coast in California, and nothing's going to change between now and then. What as a resident of California can do to spread the word on a basic level throughout the rest of the country to unify the country again?
Yes, sir. Thank you for this wonderful question. I think California has a wonderful voice, very powerful voice, member of democracy, participant in democracy, should ever underestimate the power of the voice, even single person. It is that message that I carry with me, that 26th page that this nurse wrote. Please continue to speak, even if you're left one voice, continue to speak. So it is that I suggest, that please continue to speak, organize, unite. There is an organization, I recently lent my voice to them. It's called United for Democracy. These are the lawyers of the previous administration that have so bravely came together that we will stop this nonsense that is taking place, because most of us are aware of only this law is being passed, this executive order is being passed. Very few of us are aware of what is the demolition that is taking place throughout the departments, throughout the agencies of the government. The regulations are being demolished, are removed, replaced. So this group of lawyers in Washington, D.C., and now a whole lot of current administration serving lawyers have also joined them, anonymously, of course, and they have become such a power now that every regulation that is being challenged or being replaced in Washington, D.C., they are keeping an eye on it. And the day a replacement is proposed, because there is a process, and they were the current administration's department heads and all that were going crazy, removing regulation after regulation after regulation, sometime replacing, sometime just removing them. So they begin to file FOIA requests. Hundreds of FOIA requests have been filed in these departments. Tell us why you are changing this, why you are proposing this and all. So a resistance has been built now. That demolition derby that this administration started 6 months ago had been almost halted. The reason is that if they don't respond to FOIA requests within 30 days, they have to appear before the court, before the judge, because these lawyers take them to the court and say, you have not responded to our FOIA request. Explain to us why you are changing these regulations. By these stories, what I mean to say that there is so much going on. Individuals that are uniting, that are standing up, raising their voice, playing their roles. Nobody told these lawyers that you can do this. Some of them decided that we are going to stop this demolition of our regulations that both administrations, Republicans and Democrats, have put together to run our government on fair grounds and all that. So that is what is taking place in various parts of the country. And it is that that gives me hope that with that many patriots, that many advocates of democracy and fairness, we will prevail, we shall prevail. After this anomaly is over, there is going to be so much work that needs to be done. And believe me, there are thoughtful people in throughout the country. There are thoughtful people that are preparing themselves that this is what will be done. This is what I am privy to those steps that they are planning, that how we will recuperate, how we will recover. And that is why I am so hopeful that there is the rising of the sun is just beyond the horizon. Therefore, we must remain hopeful and we must remain positive about our values, the fundamental values of this country, this government, this democracy, and we shall prevail and we shall remain. If we have lost that position momentarily, we will regain the position of being the beacon of hope for the rest of the world. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, and God bless. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm so honored. Thank you. Thank you. Please. Please.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.